Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Why do people sometimes fall in love with someone who is all kinds of wrong for them? Their friends and family see lots of red flags about their partner, but they themselves miss these warnings entirely, sometimes to catastrophic consequences. My guest today argues that these kinds of errors in relational decision-making happen when someone lets his heart rule without also heeding his head. His name is John Van Epp. He's a counselor and the author of the book, How to Avoid Falling in Love with a Jerk. We begin our conversation discussing what society's default template for creating a successful relationship looks like and how it leads people astray. John then defines what makes a jerk, and the signs you're dating a jerk. He then explains why it is that people so often miss these signs by using a model of how attachment develops in a relationship, and I think this model is super useful in understanding relational dynamics, and you don't want to miss it. We then discuss why men need to do a better job in helping pace relationships instead of only letting women set the tempo. And we end our conversation discussing the things you need to know about a person that you're forming a relationship with, including their relationship skills, family life, and values, before you escalate your commitment to them. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/lovethinks. All right, John Van Epp, welcome to the show.
It's very exciting. Thank you so much for having me.
So you are a counselor, and you've written a book called How to Avoid Falling in Love with a Jerk, a foolproof way to follow your heart without losing your mind. So this book, How to Avoid Falling in Love with a Jerk, it's based on a marriage program or a premarital program you developed called PIC. What is PIC and what issues are you trying to address in this program?
Yeah, so way back in the mid-90s, I developed the concepts, kind of worked it through, and put it in a certification course where people could get certified to actually go out, get our workbooks, get this training, and facilitate it in their own respective locations. So that was kind of my multiplying my efforts. So it's not me doing all the work. And it really took off. We started to have singles organizations. The military grabbed it as we headed into the 2000s. Social agencies, community initiatives that had federal and state grant money. And by the time we reached the end of 2000s and hit 2010-11, we had over 1 million people having gone through the program being taught by all these certified instructors. And in the middle of that, McGraw-Hill published the book. So the content of the book and then the course itself has a lot of overlap.
And with the PIC program, is this for people like couples who are thinking about getting married or about to get married, or even people who marriage isn't on the radar yet, but it's a plan later on in life?
Well, sure. So I think if somebody is in a serious relationship, I think this would be really great material for them to go through. But I really, to be honest, it was designed to go what I call upstream. I wanted to reach pre-relational people, people that were just maybe had been in a relationship, or young people even, or divorced people that came out of a relationship and they were just kind of saying, hey, we need a better template of what to get to know about somebody and how to build a healthy relationship. Because the template we've used or the template we've learned just isn't really effective, or it's not worked. And so that was really my target audience. And it's been that way. We've had over 100,000 kids in public schools go through the PIC program with you know, instructors coming into the school systems and teaching it. And that's been pretty cool. So it's pretty far upstream. And then you know, we've worked a lot with adult singles of all ages. So I think that that's really the primary place where I'd really like to see your listeners say, hey, let's look into this even more. You know, I'm not interested in a serious relationship right now. Okay, good. You are the very person that I want to look into this material and think about it and take it, because now is the best time pre-relationally.
Well, I think it's interesting you're teaching this stuff to high school students, because this is like important stuff, like your marriage, your relationship is like one of the biggest things and have the biggest impact on your life. Yet we don't really talk, we don't teach kids like what they should look for in a partner. So you mentioned we have a template that we kind of fall back to because we don't get this sort of intentional instruction. What does that template look like and why isn't it not effective?
Yeah, so the template that people fall back on is usually what I consider to be several different unanalyzed beliefs that tend to drive the culture at large. One is intuition. I'll know when I know. You know, when I'm in with somebody, it's kind of the click factor. As soon as things click with me and this person, and I just know when I know. Nobody needs to teach me anything. I just kind of figure it out and I know it intuitively. The second, and that doesn't work. There are some people that perhaps do have that innate ability, but the vast majority of people don't have that good of judgment, or you might say they haven't been trained to have their intuition function at such a high level of really knowing and being able to predict long-term relationship potential of an individual that they have some kind of chemistry or attraction to. A second, I would say, template that's used is the belief that relationships that are healthy or good, or it's kind of a dichotomy. It's either healthy or unhealthy, good or bad, you know, functional or dysfunctional. And they have this dichotomy and they believe that if it's on the positive side of the dichotomy, they're good, they're healthy, they're functioning, then a relationship just runs itself. You know, if I have to work at it, that must mean something's wrong with it. And that concept, anybody that has ever had a long-term relationship, a friendship even, knows that unless you have some kind of concerted effort, ongoing energy investment into the relationship tends to start deflating. And so, but still, we believe this. We believe it more about a romantic relationship than any other. I'll just know when I know, the click factor, it's in my intuition. And if it's really good, it just kind of does its own thing. It just goes at its own pace and it runs itself. And I don't have to have any kind of training, information, involvement. And, you know, it's kind of like asking people, when do you feel is the right time to have sex? A lot of people just say, well, you know, I'll just kind of know when I know and when it feels right. And it's that intuition. And, you know, the relationship will just kind of go there when it's the right time to go there, as if the relationship is this thing outside of myself and the other person, and I don't have any involvement in pacing how this relationship develops. Those two things I found were extremely detrimental, and they left lots of burned, crashed relationships in people's histories. And actually, then all of those hardship experiences get brought into the next relationship and complicate things even more. So we kind of came up with a different way of getting to know somebody and building a relationship and actually being more informed and intentional. And we found it to be way more successful of all ages, by the way.
So you mentioned that intuition can result in people, if they're not lucky, they might luck out, but typically they don't. Just relying on intuition can lead you to end up falling for a jerk. So for definitions, how do you define a jerk? What makes a jerk in a marriage or a relationship?
Well, I think the starting point, Brad, is all of us at one time or another act like jerks, right? Can you admit that as well?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you didn't elaborate on it. You know, everybody would like to hear a story too from you, but we'll go on.
I'm sure they would.
Let you off the hook. But I'll say for myself, you know, I've made very jerk decisions over the, I'm, I'm in my 60s now. And so been married for 40 years. And in my relationship with my kids, my wife, I mean, we all make mistakes and errors. So the word is not trying to say, first of all, that you got to find a person that is perfect. The second thing I would say about what the word is not saying, these are kind of disclaimers, is that the word is not saying that that jerks are a particular gender. We'll call it, we all gender neutral, no matter what you are or how you define yourself as a human being, everybody can act like a jerk. But I would say there is a marked difference between acting like a jerk and what we will say is being a jerk. So a couple things. First, I'll just say some simple signs of jerkiness is lack of clear insight into how their behavior is impacting other people that they're in a relationship with. That makes people a little jerky. Some people have that insight, but they don't have any real care about how they're, you know, they're like, wow, you know, you made somebody really feel bad. Well, that's their problem. I'm not responsible for their feelings. So there's either lack of insight or care about how my words or my actions impact others. I think a second kind of sign or warning flashing signal that this person could be a bit jerky is if they're really woefully lacking some relationship skills, like the skill of empathy or the skill of apology, how to admit their faults and to talk things through, woefully lacking communication or how to handle conflicts. And so there's these warning signals, but I would say we could probably spend this entire time making a list of all of the things that people can do that would be, you know, throw them in a category of acting like a jerk. But the bottom line of being a jerk is they have a persistent resistance to addressing and actually changing whatever gets put on the table is bothering others. So in other words, when you're in a relationship with somebody, one of the key areas to kind of look for, I call it a global characteristic of a person, is do they have the change factor? Do they have the ability to have insight into themselves, see something that kind of keeps repeating as a pattern and bothering you? And when it gets put on the table and you talk about it, they actually take it to heart, they take responsibility, and they do something to make a change. That sounds simple, but there are a lot of people in relationships that are unwilling to address issues that a person's put on the table, or maybe multiple people put on the table that, hey, this is something about you that offends others, bothers others. I really like to try to change this. Well, and they have a defense resistance to that. So I would just start with a very kind of simple definition of the difference between acting like a jerk versus being a jerk is whether a person has the change factor. They have a willingness to be open and receptive to something about themselves that needs to be addressed and changed, and they put in some concerted effort to do it.
Well, and the problem you highlight in the book is that people don't typically realize they're in a relationship with a jerk, someone who's, you know, has jerkiness qualities, till months in, a year in, and by then they're so entwined in the relationship that it's like hard to get out. And you're like, man, how did I get into this? Like, how did I miss this when I was first started dating this person?
I call it the head and the heart need to work together, and accelerated bonds. So when you get into a relationship, there's something that is attracting you. It could be a kind of a sexual chemistry. You could be really attracted to the person. If it's got some romantic aspect to it, then you would expect that there's some kind of a attraction, and hopefully it's mutual attraction. And that is like a magnet pulling you toward each other. But then there are bonds, major bonds, that I say exist in every relationship, whether it's romantic or not, that I put together in a tool that we call the relationship attachment model. It's this kind of graphic, that's going to date me if I call it a graphic equalizer. But if it's a, if you think of a soundboard with sliders that go up and down, it is depicted, these bonds that occur in all of our relationships are depicted as a slider. And they can have a very low level and they can move up to a very high level. And what I say is there's somewhat of a progression. People don't realize which bonding, you know, factor, which aspect of the relationship is going up really high, but they get into a relationship and some of those areas of connection in the relationship, what I call these bonds, some of them go up super fast, almost superficially, and they don't fully know the person. So the no is actually the first of the five sliders, how much I know this person or they know me. And that might be actually very low, but their trust or their reliance or even their touch in terms of just attraction and so forth, or even getting involved sexually, those things can go up super fast, create premature feelings of bond and closeness. Why are they premature? Well, they're premature because my bond is greater than what I truly know about this person. So I don't know if they're a jerk or not a jerk. I don't know what the patterns are of how this person's going to act. I know how they've treated me. I know what we've experienced together in the 6 weeks we've been seeing each other. And now we're sleeping together. And I'm kind of like dropped my friends and I'm spending bulk of my time. So another slider in this model I developed is called rely, how much I depend on this person or how much I've kind of put into a sense of them depending on me or me depending on them, how we're meeting each other's needs. So we're a lot of my needs are now all getting funneled into this relationship with this person of 6 weeks. And if you go to my trust, which is another level, that is like all the way up because everything's been good so far. For 6 weeks, everything's been good. But my no is locked into actually time. And you can't get to know the patterns of a person until there's been enough time for certain things to surface. And then a pattern by definition is something that keeps repeating. So there has to be additional time beyond its surfacing for something to actually repeat. Well, 6 weeks, a lot of times is not enough time for even somebody in a relationship to get mad at you. So you don't even know how they're going to treat you if they're mad at you. So here you are sleeping with them, channeling a lot of your needs and the reliance and your belief in them, your trust belief is way up and that yet your no is really low. And that is the norm for how many, many people today are building relationships. And it really is a recipe. It's a potential recipe for catastrophe because as your no goes up a little more and you're around the corner of what we call the 90-day probation period, right when things are really starting to surface that didn't surface in the beginning. And maybe some things are starting to repeat. So you're starting to see a few patterns. All of a sudden you hit this 3 month mark, this 90 day. And all of a sudden you'd be like, I thought I knew this person, but I'm really wondering, do I really know them? And people are shocked as if they thought they fully knew them, but their knowing wasn't high on that level. It was their trust. It was their rely and dependence and meeting each other's needs. And it was their touch was super high. So I can explain that model a little more in kind of a more organized way, but just answering your question, why do people get involved all of a sudden realize I thought I knew this person. They seemed great, but now they look like a jerk. It's because our definition of a jerk was they're not acting like a jerk 24/7. It's that there is a repeating pattern that doesn't surface typically in the beginning of a relationship, but over time begins to surface. And when addressed, does not change and starts to have major defenses on it changing. So accelerated relationships are the norm. They've been the norm for a long, long time. You know, I was growing up in the 70s and accelerated relationships were happening when I was in high school back in the 70s. And so all of those decades ever since, accelerated relationships have just become more and more the norm. But I think that they are a very unwise way and a very risky way that we do relationships. And we need to talk about guys for a minute. So I'll let you keep asking questions, but I do want to kind of speak directly to guys as stepping up, being pacemakers of relationships rather than saying guys will just do whatever women let them do.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, let's talk about, sort of summarize this relationship attachment model, because I thought it was a very useful tool for people. So the idea is, because there's these five sliders, which you call bonding areas. And the first one is no. Then you say trust, rely, commit, and touch. And the way you talk about it in the book is that in a relationship, you have to go through these in a progression, right? You can't go too fast. Like you said, you can't accelerate to touch before you get to know the person, because that's just going to lead to disaster. Or commit. Like, there's a lot of people who end up moving in with somebody, but they don't really know them. They find out the person has lots of debt. And they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't know you had. Or like, you've been in jail? I did not know you've been in jail. And like, and so that's what you want to make sure you know. And like, I think the big takeaway I got from that is that you never want to go further in one bonding area than you have gone in the previous. So like, you never want to go, say if you're still in the no period of a relationship, you don't want to overcommit or over rely or over trust before you get to know that person better.
That's a very, very perfect description of it. So if people are kind of imaginative, they can imagine in their mind this image of five sliders going up and down. And what you just said is no, starting from the left, it would be no, and then trust, and then rely, and then commit, and then touch. And exactly what you said, they're representative of a piece of the whole of what a relationship is. A relationship is the interaction of these five areas: how much I know somebody, what my know, how it interacts with how I trust them, how that interacts with how they meet my needs or I meet their needs, and how we rely. And these things are like two-way streets. So you could get a little more complicated with the model and say it's not just how I know them, but how I have let them get to know me, or how they trust me and I trust them. So they do have a little more complications. We start thinking of them as two-way streets, but they are pieces of the whole. And when you think of a brand new relationship, any relationship, there's just an intuitive wisdom to not let a level go higher or faster or develop in a greater way than any of the levels to the left. So you're right. If the no is kind of low, then I shouldn't have my trust go significantly higher than what I know somebody. If I'm trusting somebody way beyond what I know them, it definitely puts me at risk. But even if my no is up a little bit, if my trust isn't fully developed and I step into, like you said, moving in with them, that makes my commitment really high. We have lots of interesting research. Literally, I don't know if everyone knows this, but there have been over 1,000 research studies on moving in together outside of marriage. I'm talking about in academic journals. They don't have any particular, you know, religious, almost always out of university settings. But, and then there are, because there's so many research studies that have been done, there have been what they call meta studies, which then take, you know, all of the research that was done from like 1980 to 2015. And let's take all of the research and group it, you know, on cohabitation in unmarried relationships. So unmarried people moving in together. Let's take all of that research for those last 15 or 20 years, whatever the meta study is looking at. Basically, a summary of it confirms this logic, this intuitive logic of my model, that the people that move in together are forming a reliance way higher than their trust typically, and way higher than what they know somebody. So the no, trust, rely, commit, touch progression, their rely is really high, their touch is really high, their commitment is kind of skewed. They don't want to go to a full commitment of marriage, which truly is historically the greatest commitment. It is, you know, we are going to commit together to be together as a union for life. That's been the historic definition of what marriage is. So it is the highest commitment. And they're not ready for that, but their rely is really high. Their commitment is a little bit crooked, you might say, and mid-range. Their touch is all the way to the top. Their trust is mid-range because they're not quite sure if they can believe everything good about this person, but they have enough to move in together. And their no, even though they might say their no is really high, there's a ton of things that they don't know about each other. What all the research in the meta-analysis, as well as most of the individual studies, you can't really find any good research that says this approach of moving in and then eventually getting married is producing better marriages. But there is a lot of research that says the breakup rates are significantly higher than the breakup rates in marriage. And you might be like, well, that's good. So they move in together, they realize it's not going to work out, and they break up. But we also find the after effects of those breakups can be more similar to the after effects of divorce than ever realized. And so people are thinking this is like a no fault, no risk approach to checking out a relationship, and they move in and their hearts are bonded and they're living together and their rely is really high, and maybe they see problems, and because their reliance is so high and they bought a house together, they're living together and they both put money out and bought a house. Now their dependence, their co-interdependency has just moved significantly up. Or they bought a dog together, even that. Or in the millennial generation, which is what, maybe 22, 23 years old to 38 years old now, having a kid when you're not married in that generation is now over 50%. It's 55%. And just a quick stat, they looked at these moms that are having kids when they're not married, and they asked them, how many of you are going to eventually marry the father of your child? Well, it was around 70% said, yeah, you know, we're going to marry the father of our child. They did a 5-year follow-up with these millennial moms, and only 16% 5 years later had married the dads. And over 50, it was actually 65%+ had moved on to another guy. So just think how complicated life is becoming. So I am elaborating on what you said, but there is an intuitive logic that says, as you get to know somebody, and we can talk, Brett, about what does it mean to get to know somebody? What are the key areas? But as you get to know somebody, let the ceiling of how much you truly know them, let that set the ceiling of your trust. And as you are getting to know them and checking out your trust based on that, we call it the three T's, by the way. You got to talk, so that's good to get to know them and build trust. But second T is you've got to be together in various situations and moods and, you know, kind of states of life, you know, when they're stressed or when they're angry or when they're, we already said, when they're mad at you. This togetherness and diverse moods and settings takes the third T. It takes a lot of time. So if you let your no set the ceiling for your trust and how you know and believe in them, as that's getting tested out, you keep pulling back your reliance to keep a little bit of a balanced life, not overly investing. The same with your commitment. And if you pace it that way, and then you do everything you can to hold your physical involvement with them in check. I know everybody's like, man, just you gotta jump in the sack and check things out right away. But all research from biological to psychological and social finds that jumping in the sack with somebody, even in a hookup, creates chemicals in the brain that prompt a sense of connection and bond. And so we're creating bonds that don't match the other kind of areas of the relationship. And this skewed kind of like sense of I'm bonded to them. I can't stop thinking about them. I'm spending my time with them. But this other area is not fully developed, like how much I know them, whether I can fully trust them. These areas are not fully developed. Whether they really will meet my needs in responsible ways, or whether they will be kind of more self-running and self-focused. And I didn't realize that for the first few months. Doing a relationship with the logic of the relationship attachment model, that kind of intuitive logic, don't let a level go higher than the previous to the left. That has saved a ton of people heartache and decisions, and helped them to kind of use it as, I call it a relationship GPS system, to help them navigate their relationship in a way that is wise and safe and actually very rewarding.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code manliness to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code manliness. Check it out today. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, clean up's a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50. And use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's a good deal. That's code manliness50, manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So, for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show. So earlier you mentioned you want to talk about guys being kind of taking charge and being a part of this pacing of it. So talk to that. Why? What role does a guy have in a relationship in pacing the relationship?
Yeah, this is, this has been, so I had a counseling practice, if I back up, in Northern Ohio for 25 years. And it was something that just bothered me so much. And then after, designing programs, so we have a lot of programs now. I don't have a private practice anymore, but we have a lot of programs that have been trying to do more preventative than remedial work. Obviously, a counseling practice does a lot of remedial work, trying to fix something that broke. And like now, I want to just help people try to avoid things breaking down by making better decisions on the front end. One of the things that always just kind of got me was this sense that respecting what a woman wants and what she's willing to do in our relationship is the role of the man. He is just to be thoughtful and respectful and not pressure her in any kind of way. And if he does that, then that is enough to be, an outstanding, art of manliness guy. Okay. And I'm like, okay, that is all good, but that's not good enough. The man should, he should be selective about who he's getting involved with. He should have some criteria of what he wants from a female and what he doesn't like in a female. And he should definitely have some kind of a value system about how to intentionally pace the acceleration of the relationship. And if she is like, on the third time they're hanging out together, she's like, hey, why don't you come up to my apartment? He's like, are you sure? Is that okay with you? That's great with me. That permission that she is giving doesn't remove the responsibility he has of saying, hey, I'm pacing this relationship and I'm going to tell her, I think this is kind of early to be jumping in together. And, I'd like to, man, I'm attracted to you. I find it's an exciting conversation to even talk about this, but, I'm going to hold back because I really think that if we do this relationship differently, we might be able to either develop a really great relationship and see where it's going. And that's going to be a totally different landscape if we do this relationship a little differently. And I'd love to talk about why that's important to me. I just found even parents didn't teach their boys that this is a responsibility of a young man or an older man, a middle-aged man, it doesn't matter. This is a responsibility of the man in the relationship, not just the woman. And so forever, it seems like women were the gatekeepers of any kind of sexual involvement. And it went beyond that. They were actually not just the gatekeepers, but the relationship managers. This is a big problem in marriage. A lot of wives want their husbands to join with them and be relationship managers. Hey, why don't you plan a date? Why don't you think about something that'd be fun to do? Why don't you look at what we need in our relationship? Why don't you come to me and say, we got to improve our communication? Why am I always the one doing all this? Well, it goes all the way back to how boys are raised. And boys are raised to not be relationship managers and to not be the gatekeepers of the physical sexual area of a relationship. And so I say we've got to up the kind of the responsibility and the empowerment of men in relationships. Men should be much more engaged and they should be much more kind of positive about taking this on. Like, hey, this is a good thing. I want to have some involvement. When my wife and I dated back at the end of the 70s, we met in college and we dated in college before we got married for a couple of years. And you know, I'm thankful looking back. I was very much a relationship manager. Meaning, what do I mean by that? I was thinking about, hey, what is going on in our relationship? Where are we? What are things we need to talk about? I would bring up topics. I would prompt things. It was a mutual, you know, we both did it, but I can remember even as a 19, 20 year old being very engaged in that way. And I definitely was thoughtful and we talked about what we were going to do in our physical relationship and what boundaries we were going to set and not do. And that helped us to establish kind of a best friend relationship that has been foundational now for, like I said, over 40 years. So I just think that there's no way to get around that. And if we help men develop that sense of role in relationships, it empowers men and gives them way more sense of thoughtfulness and involvement than I think a lot of times they've had in the past.
And women will appreciate it too.
I think so. And what I would say, if a guy's doing this well, so we're not talking about control freaks. So just to put a couple of disclaimers out there, we're not talking about control freaks. We're not talking about interrogation. We're not talking about authoritarian approaches. None of those things I'm talking about. I'm talking about just upping their involvement and being thoughtful about the relationship and actually engaging in the relationship on a regular basis from the very beginning all the way on into long-term committed relationships. And absolutely, the partner will be very, very appreciative of it. And if not, then that guy ought to really step back and think about, what does this say about this partner that doesn't like me getting involved and taking some charge of this whole arena of, you know, what we do together, what we talk about, and what our physical relationship is like. Why is she like this? You know, what does that mean about her? Because I would say that's a red flag.
So yeah, that idea that, you know, happy wife, happy life, that's not good. It's probably going to lead to a lot of heartache and just not having a good time.
Happy wife. Well, if that is interpreted to be happy wife, happy life. So all that means is I can be totally passive. If that's the interpretation, then I agree that that's not a good. But if happy wife means, hey, if I engage, if I've involved, if I'm helping to pace the relationship, if I'm managing it in a mutual way, if I'm thinking about what she needs as well as what I need, and we're putting those things on the table, and I'm an initiator, not just a responder. And if I am doing those things, I would say you're going to have a much happier wife and a happier life as well. Because those are the things, if you read all the books, they'll all be saying the same thing. Guys need to step into that kind of involvement. And I'm just putting it upstream. At the very beginning of a relationship, guys need to be stepping in and they need to be told, this is a good thing for you to do.
So let's talk about, kind of delve deep into the no factor. Because in the book, you spend a lot of time in this no area of bonding. Because I think it's hard in the dating arena today. Oftentimes people are dating complete strangers. Like they meet at college, they're from, you know, their potential partners from Detroit, they're from California. It used to be like way back in the 19th century, like you grew up in the same hometown, families knew each other, generations, like you knew the person, not so anymore. So what does it mean to know somebody in a relationship?
Yeah, you're so right. I came across this book written right on the edge of 1950. So it was kind of coming out of the 40s, which was, if you think back to history, that's, you know, World War II, and we came out of the Depression and all those things. And it was also the era where we had not quite yet stepped into the 1950s of suburbs, right? People lived in the cities. And anyway, it was by Burgess, the leading sociologist of that time period. And it was a book on called, I think, Love, Marriage, and Courtship. It was a great little book I found. And I came across this study that in the 70 percentile, I don't remember exactly if it was 73 or 74%, but of the people in a study in the city of Philadelphia, people that got married, married somebody that they had lived within six blocks of. So 70, we'll say that we're up at the 75%. So three out of four people were marrying somebody that was in their neighborhood. And you're absolutely right. That is not really what's going on in this day and age. People are meeting online and building long distance relationships on a very, very regular basis and meeting in different settings where they have come from, you know, backgrounds that are very diverse. And the diversity is great. I love diversity, but understand diversity makes figuring out compatibility much more complicated. It's not that relationships have become simpler. They've become more complicated. And yet the relationship information for what we're talking about being upstream has, I think, really been depleted. So, you know, the people guiding the process and friends and relatives and family, you know, it's just kind of all dropped off and people are marrying much later. So they're more independent and on their own. And they almost become dependent on, you know, like assessments online. Like I'll take eHarmony and then I'll do this assessment and it will start helping me connect with people. And okay, so this is where wisdom is found, is in some kind of an online assessment. And I like things like that, but I think we need to go way, way beyond that. So empowering singles with key target areas to explore and talk about in their relationship. These are the most important areas to get to know. And we want you to understand them, to have some in-depth kind of information about them, because you are the one running your relationship, not some online assessment. You're the one that is ultimately making decisions, not some algorithm. And so we want you to be empowered with this so you can go into it. This really came out of, Brett, when I was in my private practice in the mid-90s. I was also teaching marriage and family coursework in graduate school. And I came across some research that had to do with characteristics of people before marriage and how they predict some kind of outcome after marriage. So some of them were individual characteristics. Some of them were kind of relationship characteristics, but they were things basically that you could get to know about somebody before marriage that predicted how that person seemed to function after marriage and what the outcomes would be. And I thought, I wonder how many research studies have been conducted on something about a person, you know, like unmarried characteristics that predict marriage outcomes. So I set myself, and that's really how this book came about, I set myself on the journey of collecting all of the research I could find that was about that. And I found hundreds of research studies that nobody had ever organized or cataloged, and I began to put them in categories and found that there were really five key areas that covered the vast majority, almost all of this research. And so I put them in a little acronym and they became five core chapters of my book. So, and they are also in the PIC program and we have an online version so people can, they don't have to go to a live class. They could just jump online. We call it Head Meets Heart and it goes through the same areas, it goes through that relationship attachment model we've talked about. Goes more in depth into those five areas. And then it goes very in depth into the five key areas to get to know about somebody that we're talking about right now.
And what are those five key areas, just as a summary?
Okay. So I'll put them in the order of the book. So they're a little different order in the programs, but in the book, they start with kind of what I thought would be the logic. Like you meet somebody and you start hanging out together. You know, we use the word dating as we've been talking, but I don't know who uses that word anymore. Relationships have become so undefined, which is like a whole nother topic. But when I go on college campuses now and everything, they say if somebody is dating, they don't call it dating anymore. They call it talking. So what are you guys doing? We're talking. So that's what it is. So I just tried to be like, okay, what would be the logical progression of these five areas? And they're not, you know, it's not cut in stone and they're not like finish one and go to the other, but usually the first thing that you begin to see is what I call compatibility potential. So you see, like you're talking to somebody and it's that click factor that I mentioned earlier. It's that sense of chemistry. It's some commonality. And so I define three major areas of compatibility that I think go a lot deeper than just that initial, but I think that's kind of it. You know, do we feel a little bit compatible with this person? And then the second major area is relationship skills. And so you kind of figure that out, you know, how does the person talk? How does the person handle themselves with me? How do they interact with me in terms of their skill level? If you think of a relationship skill, if we want to define that, just think in relationships, there are activities that we do. We talk, we share, open up. That's all parts of talking. We plan things to do together. So there's activities, whether it's recreation, whether it's a project, whether it's work. We support each other. We make priorities. We meet each other's needs. That takes a lot. We can figure out what the person needs. I call it being a connoisseur of another person. You know, how much am I an expert on what this other person needs, right? So these are activities. The proficiency of how good you are at a particular activity is your skill level. So skills are not some separate category of the activities that make up what we do in relationships. Skills are just the measure of proficiency that we have at doing that. So how good am I at talking and listening would start to fall into what we call a communication skill. So obviously, you start hanging with somebody, you not only initially see this first category that I said of how are we clicking, what's our compatibility, what's our chemistry, but then you also are doing activities together and you start to see how good they are at these particular activities. Those two things, by the way, are not enough to really tell you what this person is like. They are important areas, but there are other areas that don't surface so quickly. And the third one is what I called a relationship scripts, how a person treats everybody else. Like what, forget about how they treat you. Think about how they treat a coworker or an authority figure or, you know, their family or extended family or how they treated an ex or how they broke up with that ex or how they talk about people. You know, a lot of times how they're treating me doesn't really match how they treat some other significant people in their life. Even maybe a stranger or somebody that is, you know, a waiter or waitress, you know, a service person. Sometimes how they treat these other people in other arenas is starkly different than how they treat me, but I like how they treat me, but you know, so that's their business. But a lot of times those scripts over time start to get turned into the relationship and they start surfacing in the relationship. So they're not a good friend. They don't like pay a lot of attention to a person that they're quote friends with, or maybe certain family members, they kind of tune them out. They don't look very conscientious toward those people. And they never like pursue, like, shouldn't you call your brother or yeah, whatever. Or your friend, you know, your friend always reaches out to you, but you never really reach out to them. And you see this kind of passivity in how they treat others, but that they're so involved with me and they're constantly with me and they're constantly talking to me. And we've been together now 2.5 months and man, I don't even pay attention to their relationship scripts with others. Huge red flag, because it's really likely that as you round the corner from 3 months into maybe 13 months, passing your first year, all of a sudden, or maybe even second year, you start to see some of those relationship scripts are starting to become normative in how they relate to me. And that was, I could see it in the first couple months of our relationship, but I minimized it because I didn't think it had any significance. Compatibility, their actual skill level of relationship activities and things that they do, the scripts of how they treat others, their relationship patterns with others, that's number three. Now we start to get into the really deep stuff. What they learned, the fourth one is what they learned and have taken out of their family upbringing. This is not easy to get to know in the beginning of a relationship, because usually if we hear anything about family, we just hear some easygoing stories about families. But you have to look really hard. Family upbringing, whether it was adopted family, biological parent family, a single parent family, whether it was an institutional, a foster family, or they group home, whatever, everybody grew up. And during those, 18 years, whatever period of time you want to say, they were growing up, experiencing and internalizing things from those family dynamics, from how the family related, how they were treated, and they become some of the strongest predictors of what they're going to then take out and, reestablish in the families they establish or the relationships that they establish in their adulthood. So the fourth area is what I would say, what they learned and took out of their family. It's not always what happened, but it's what they took out. And the final one, which is extremely important, and I haven't found anybody to talk about it but me, and that's the conscience. People have a conscience. It's the dynamic value system that operates in them, but there's a relationship conscience. There is a sense of not just right and wrong, but empathy is prompted by the conscience. The conscience is like that internal voice that monitors you as you are living life. It tells you, stop, slow down, don't do that. I'll just mention a show, a lot of people when Seinfeld was on, and now they watch all the reruns, but going to some of the writer, not just Jerry Seinfeld, but then Larry David and then the Larry David show. Well, if you want to see someone that depicts what good old Sigmund Freud called a Swiss cheese conscience, I think Larry David is like the perfect example, where sometimes he's super conscientious and then other times he's like so in your space. He's so inappropriate with somebody. But we all laugh at it, if you like the show. If you don't like the show, please don't be offended. But, there's a lot of humor there. But he is showing kind of that conscience that some things stick, some things just go right through, and he seems so uninsightful, unempathetic, and so forth. This doesn't always reveal itself right away. These five areas, how you and I click together, the key areas of our compatibility, how skilled you are in some of the most important areas of relationship activities like communication, problem solving, conflict, empathy, apologies, things like that. The third is how do you treat other people? Because that's such a strong predictor of how you act in relationships in general, and it's probably going to come into our relationship. And then let's get deeper into our family stuff. What did you take out of your family? And then finally, deep inside of you, what is the maturity and the functioning of that conscience that is such a strong influence on how you live your life and then how you're going to ultimately relate to me in a relationship?
And this, like you said, it takes talking, it takes being together, and it takes time, a lot of time, a lot more time than you think it's going to take.
It does. And if I put those five areas back into that relationship attachment model, going from left to right is no. And then as a drop-down box, just think about these five areas. What am I getting to know about compatibility? What am I getting to know about skills? What am I getting to know about their relationship scripts? What am I getting to know on a deeper level about their family and what they took out of it and how those experiences have shaped them? And what am I getting to ultimately know about their character and conscience and this inner side? And as I get to know those key areas, which definitely take time, you can't sit down with somebody and pull out a, you know, 101 questions and say, while we're waiting for dinner to come, I thought I would just kind of, you know, ask some questions here that came from this podcast that was really interesting on how to avoid getting involved with a jerk. Now, I'm not saying you're a jerk, but let's go through these questions. I have 20 for each of five categories.
This sounds
you can't do that at that point.
Larry David would do that.
Larry David would do that, of course. But if you know these areas, and in my book, I do have about 20, 25 questions for each of these five areas. So over 100 questions. If you know the question, if you know the target areas and the questions, then as time goes on and it feels comfortable, these things can just become part of the fabric of how you're talking together. And as your no slowly goes up, it tells you how you can trust and believe in them. And it tells you how much you can look to them and depend on them. And these three actually all interact, how they meet my needs, how I trust them, how they come through for me, what they share, what we talk about. And as they interact, they inform how invested I should become in my commitment and where I should set some boundaries in our physical relationship, the touch.
Well, John, we've talked about a lot right now, but there's so much more we could talk about. I think we got to have you back on the show to discuss this more. But in the meantime, where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
Oh, well, that'd be great. Well, first of all, I would love to come back on anytime. Just let me know. I'd be glad to. And we have some free things, and then we have some things that can be purchased. And so let me just start with the book. So, I mean, they can just jump on Amazon and find the book that way. That's no problem. Again, it's published by McGraw-Hill, and it's called How to Avoid Falling in Love with a Jerk. But if they also go to My Love Thinks, like love, L-O-V-E, thinks, T-H-I-N-K-S, not stinks, but and it's my, you know, My Love Thinks, because we say love should think. It should not just be intuitive. The head and the heart should work together. So if they go to My Love Thinks, they can get a lot of free resources. We have a whole library of free resources, and we have a blog that's free that is always giving information. There is also, we have online courses, and right there from My Love Thinks, they can click online courses. And if they use the code Art of Man, A-R-T-O-F-M-A-N, Art of Man, they can get a 20% discount on any of our online courses. And the online course that goes with the content we've been talking about is called Head Meets Heart. So it's about the head and heart working together, obviously. And then finally, Dr. Morgan Cutlip, who happens to be my daughter, we work closely together. She's very involved in all this. She has an Instagram, My Love Thinks, where she puts out daily relationship tips. She also does the blog that I mentioned on My Love Thinks. But if you go to at My Love Thinks on Instagram, you can sign in and get these, you know, free resources just from her kind of daily tips. And they really are good. I think they're helpful. She kind of goes through the spectrum of singles on into committed relationships and marriage.
Well, fantastic. Well, John Van Epp, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great talking to you.
My guest is John Van Epp. He's the author of the book, How to Avoid Falling in Love with a Jerk. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find out more information about his work at his website, lovethinks.com, not lovestinks.com, lovethinks.com. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/lovethinks, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com where you can find our podcast archives as well as thousands of articles we've written over the years. A lot of things about relationships on there. Check that out. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout to get a free trial of Stitcher Premium. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you can start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, whatever platform you use to listen to the podcast. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who would think we get something out of it. Shoot him a text. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you not only listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
We're in a period of rapid change, and sometimes it can feel like things are spinning out of control. With political tensions, anxiety, and loneliness rising, and questions about how to live a good life on everyone's mind, finding answers can seem harder than ever. For millennia, spiritual thinkers have offered wisdom and tools to help people find their way in trying times, advice that even a scientist like me, Dave DeSteno, is finding have a lot to offer. To join the conversation, look for How God Works wherever you listen to podcasts.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.